This is the Amp Hour Podcast, released November 12th, 2023, episode 650, Accessible ASICs with Andreas Olofsson. Welcome to the Amp Hour. I'm Chris Gammel of Contextual Electronics.
I'm Andreas Olofsson from Zero ASIC.
Welcome back, Andreas. How are you?
Thank you, Chris. I'm good.
I was re-listening this morning to our last time you were on the show, episode, I should have this up here, 254, different times, different companies, different life stages we were all at. So I'm glad to have you back. You've been doing some very impressive things in the meantime.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. Yeah, I was kind of blocked out from appearing for a while, but it's been a long ride.
I would love to hear about some of the reasons for being blocked out from appearing, because I think it's actually pretty interesting. You're in between your current thing and the thing you were on last time for. Let's talk about the last time, though. So last time you were on for the Parallella, which was your company was making. Adaptiva, am I spelling it wrong? I may have spelled it wrong on the show notes. But
Adaptiva.
Adaptiva. Yeah, I spelled it wrong in the show notes. It's been wrong. I'll correct that later. but that was a project that you would discuss spinning out for parallelization of mathematical operations, if I'm remembering the recording correctly from this morning.
That's right.
Great. How did it all go? I mean, you're not doing that anymore, so I assume it went okay, or...
I mean, yeah, people ask me that, was that a success? Was it a failure? And I chalk it up as a success, even though, everybody wants to be ARM, NVIDIA, Intel, right? If you set the bar that high, you're definitely going to fail. But we shipped, we shipped devices. Rolling back that story, right? 2008, I started a parallel processor company, which was, 15 years ago. It was, in the great recession.
Great time to start a company.
Semiconductor was the ice age of semiconductor. We wanted to find anything. And I was able to raise a little bit of money, but I didn't raise enough to really grow a semiconductor company. So I thought, let's try something different. Let's try to actually open up the specs, be more transparent with the community. And let's see if we can work with the community to create a platform instead of just trying to create everything ourselves and then just push it on everybody. So we did the Kickstarter with Parallella, open source board, made our manuals available, open source drivers and all of that. And I think it almost worked. I think the timing was off. We kept getting these questions, and I, going to customers asking, well, how are we going to program this thing? And a lot has happened in the last 15 years. And I think it was too early. Didn't raise enough money, but we still shipped 10,000, 20,000 eval boards to 10,000 customers.
Wow. Yeah. That's very impressive. Yeah,
and we shipped these all over the world. We were in 200 universities. A bunch of people used the parallel boards for publications because it was accessible and open. I think it was also cited academically fairly well, right? Because it was significant work. So I'm proud of the work we did there. It was good.
That's great. Yeah, and so again, I was re-listening this morning, and you back on the last show, you kind of described it as a math coprocessor. And what popped into my head was kind of thinking, around a lot of the growth of, there's other parallelization that has been happening. Specifically, I think about the NVIDIA, how that's, massively parallel as well. Is it kind of hitting that same space? Was it kind of targeting the same stuff there as just a framing?
Yeah, for sure. And, it comes down to, you have to have the full solution. And you have to work with your community. But we were definitely, I was watching everything that NVIDIA was doing at the time. And taking notes, they're still doing great things in terms of growing a community around their platform.
Yeah, true.
And engaging with people, CUDA and research, and just lowering the barrier for adoption in AI and machine learning. They get it, it's just, I think I don't know how many billions of dollars they've spent, but it's a lot, right, to get there.
Sure. Yeah, I was just thinking about the actual architectural differences, if there were any. Like, I'm going to once again play ignorant on, computer architecture side of things here, though. You mentioned it as like as a math coprocessor when we recorded, kind of handing off operations that are heavy math intensive things. And then what I know about like GPUs is that a lot of cores, splitting up a lot of tasks amongst cores, but it felt like there was maybe more stuff happening at each individual core. Like there's more more command handling. I don't know. I'm terrible at this stuff, but
yeah. We can get, you know, dig down as much as we want here, but mm-hmm. but I think what one of the things that NVIDIA has done that's really amazing with the GPUs, right? First of all, GPUs are available everywhere, right? So
yeah,
now right. you have the access part. It was always a big deal, and then you go, okay, how easy is it to use? And that's where their abstraction and their computer architecture model has really clicked with the community, right? They produce a software stack that really works. And I think, you know, one of the things that was different between the GPU and SIMD, which they're using, or SIMT, SIMThreads, and our multi-core CPU approach is that, you know, we kind of had a modest number of CPU cores, you know, 16, 64, and then eventually 1,000. But that meant that the user or the programmer had to really kind of think about how they partitioned the problems.
Right.
And with the GPU today, you just kind of say like, all right, we've got sort of 1,000 or 10,000 parallel threads, and then the programmer, you just have to make sure you have hundreds of thousands of threads, and then you have a kind of a scheduler in the middle to make sure that that connection is done effectively. But I'm simplifying here, but it gave a good abstraction model for the user that the programmer could use effectively. And with a multi-core, the way we were doing it, and I think a lot of AI companies are doing today, that abstraction is still too clunky.
Mm, got it. So it's like kind of a don't make me think model. That's what NVIDIA is going towards. And it's just like, it just becomes a software problem versus more of a bespoke hardware, like having to understand the underlying. Like one thing we talked about in that last episode too, in 2015, was like kind of comparing it to FPGAs as well. And just thinking like, you know, the promise of FPGAs has been floating in the air for many, 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 many years. And it's like, but there is so much knowledge required at that level, I feel like, to have, you know, you're building your own architecture, you're building your own, you know, stuff happening under the hood. And then most software people, I feel like, don't want to deal with that. They just want to, push data through. Is that fair? Or?
Yeah, I mean, every software developer is different, right? You have people doing JavaScript and Python, and people doing C++ code. So I think it's, I think in general, Verilog is harder than Python. I think that's a pretty
yes. I agree with that. Yes,
but I think actually the Verilog abstraction has been incredible, or VHDL abstraction has been incredibly successful over many decades. I can write Verilog code in, if I don't use IP blocks from a specific vendor, I can kind of push the button through, and it just works if I wrote the right RTL code. And I can run that on different vendors' FPGA devices. Even if I'm careful, take the same Verilog code and produce an ASIC without changing anything. So I think there is, I think Verilog and VHDL gets a bad rap sometimes. I think it's one of the true universal standards. But it is definitely more difficult than Python.
Yeah. It is interesting as well. So another kind of theme that I was hearing in that last episode was kind of the unit economics. That felt like that was a thing that's kind of gone through it's like a through line theme for a lot of the stuff that you were talking about then, and I'm guessing some of the stuff we're talking about now with Zero ASIC as well. But like how has that changed? Is there, I mean, we've seen some of the PDKs opening up, but I'm not sure if that's as effective at the, you know, the bleeding edge side of things. You know, it's not like TSMC is opening up. So like, has the unit economics changed in any appreciable way from what you're seeing, aside from just General Moore's law shrinking?
Yeah, and that's a great question, because having two companies, right, one in starting 2008 and one in 2020, you kind of take a snapshot and say, right, what has changed, right? Two semiconductor companies. So okay, where to start? I think first thing is, open source is a lot more developed these days than it was 2008.
At all levels, like chip design, software design, all of those?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you really think back 2008, I mean, people are still using CVS or was it SVN?
Or, yeah, you know, true. Like pre-GitHub, like, huh?
It's all Git, right?
Yeah, totally.
And on the EDA side, when I started at Optiva, right, I used Verilator, and that's still great today. It's much better today, but it was great back then too. But that was pretty much the only tool available that was good enough to use. And today, I mean, I have a meta repo on GitHub that just tracks open source projects. Huh. And it's like 400 projects on there.
That's great.
So that is just, and it keeps growing. So I think, you know, open source hardware, open source EDA, different components, it is absolutely night and day. One thing that changed.
What do you think is driving you know, there's a culture piece and like you said, Git and GitHub and things like that, you know, maybe more accessible sharing tools, I'm guessing. But like from maybe like people economic piece, is there something in the ecosystem that's allowing more people to contribute to open source? You know, like just from a people got to feed themselves.
I think it's a cultural drag along type effect.
Ah, okay.
Kicking and screaming. Software started first, right? And so you had, you know, the GCC, Stallman, Linus, right? All, you know, they were the path breaking, you know, revolutionaries, right? 80s and 90s.
Sure.
And then, you know, it was a fight, right? Against some of the big vendors to the death, and open source won. And then, you know, kind of been in the same fight in hardware. It's you know, open source is a thing that lifts all ships.
Right? Yeah.
And I've been seeing this for 15 years now, and it's tiring, to be honest with you, to have these, you know, it's like when Steve Ballmer, I think he says something like open source is a cancer or something to the effect, right? You know, I feel like we're still having those conversations today in hardware, and like, come on, it's, can we move past this, right?
Yeah.
It's
not get on the good foot, folks. Come on. Yeah. Figure it out. Yeah. Yeah, so, the chip companies being like, we were doing something radical. We're going to do open source. It's like, oh, cool. So it's just about like where it hits and when it hits, that sort of thing. Yeah, it's a really interesting piece. So open source is a big one. Some tooling sounds like. What about like the fab level economics?
So fab, I mean, I'm an advanced digital person. So if we look at, you know, analog, right? You know, different criteria, older nodes like 130 and, you know, 180. But for digital, it is incredibly expensive. So if you track 15 years, there's less fabs today than there were in 2008.
Interesting.
And it just gets more expensive. Mask sets are, you know, in $10 to $20 million per tape out. Uh-huh. And, you know, IP has gone through the roof as well. Design tools are increasing. There's less fabs to talk to. It's harder to get into those fabs as a startup. So, and of course, I mean, they know, right? They're not going to take, if the tape out is $20 million, why would they talk to somebody coming in who clearly doesn't have $20 million?
They clock you walking through the door, huh?
Yeah.
the Silicon Country Clubs, as it were. don't have the entry fee, sir, or nor the jacket required.
So that is definitely a huge barrier, and that needs to change. So I think right now I gave a talk last week that I called the semiconductor singularity, and people have talked about singularity before, but to me that means that as we scale towards one, you know, 0 nanometer, the cost and complexity goes to infinity. And that's sort of where we're trending towards, right? That the you know, there may only be one project left because that project is going to cost $1 billion to do.
Yep.
Probably for a smartphone or maybe for a data center. Mm-hmm. And there'll be one fab left because, you know, when every EUV machine costs $300 million and you need a bunch of them to stay competitive, there's like one fab left that can do that, maybe.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. Yeah. Yeah, it does make you wonder how the ASML salesperson, you know, going into TSMC, they're like, what else are you going to buy? I'm going to make my quota this month because of course I am. well, I guess I'm in the wrong business. Yeah, that's really interesting. So is anything going to change? I mean, like, are you seeing anything else shake up in the market then? I mean, I've seen some stuff and some like, for example, past guest of the show, Sam Zaloof, he's working on an atomic lab silicon, right? Like that's, you know, trying to do small scale, but that's not going to be like leading node, and nothing's really leading node. So, or is it just going to be the anyone who wants to be competitive has to pay the toll to get to the front of the line.
So no, the answer is chiplets, right?
That is okay. Okay.
You know, I'm going to keep saying that word, right? And I'll, then I'm going to define what it means. But basically, that is the savior is chiplets.
Okay. Great. Yeah, right. And so, that, and spoiler alert, folks, you know, usually we come to the things later, but that is what Zero ASIC's all about, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. Quick interlude, because I like to, you know, keep people in suspense a little bit about the current stuff. I'd love to hear about your interlude in between Adaptiva and Zero ASIC. What were you doing then? Whatever you're allowed to talk about, I suppose.
Yeah, sure. I mean, most of the stuff I talked about was public, right? Yeah. And I just have to preface with that anything I say is my own personal opinion.
Sure.
It does not represent the U.S. government, right? I'm long gone from DARPA and the U.S. government.
Yep.
And,
yep.
And all of that, right? So,
yeah, totally.
But I think, you know, the reason I went to DARPA was, first of all, somebody gave me the opportunity. They tapped my shoulder and say, hey, are you interested? But my mission there was to really reduce the barrier to design. So you can imagine, right? I basically killed myself for 9 years at Adaptiva with raised $7 million to do 5 generations of microprocessors, where, you know, Intel would have spent $1 billion.
Yeah.
And so I was working, you know, 80-hour weeks, and the team was as well, and it was just a losing battle. So I was frustrated, and so I decided I'm going to go to DARPA and, you know, fix the high cost of design. It should be possible for 3 smart people to design a chip without having to do all the other crap that you have to. Sorry, all the other stuff that you.
Crap's okay. Here.
Okay. Right. So, but yeah, it should be, you know, because in software, right, in Python, JavaScript, or in C++, you know, you can get pretty far with 3 really smart people.
Yeah.
And in hardware, that's in chip design, that's not even close.
Right.
So I went to DARPA to try to reduce the barrier to silicon. That was my mission.
I have to say, when I saw on LinkedIn that a former guest had gone to DARPA, I was like, whoa, that is, obviously you couldn't talk about it at the time, but like that's super cool. I mean, like, and so you came in with that mission, like that they brought you in to work on lowering costs of chips.
Yep. That's right.
Cool. Go DARPA.
So this was, you know, my boss at the time, Bill Chappell, who just an incredible visionary. When, you know, I actually came in, I was presenting Adaptiva and Parallel and some ideas I had to the group there, and didn't even know who he was at the time. He was the director of MTO, and he was, you know, peppering me with questions. And then basically after the presentation, he came out and asked me, have you ever thought about working for the government? That was it. I was hooked. So, and that's then he asked me to come up with a mission, and I pitched the mission to him, and he said, sounds great. When are you ready to come? So
that's great. That's like I saw the, you know, they started that digital agency a couple years back for like people that come to do service, like the healthcare.gov, and like helping all the, what do they call it? The digital something. I don't remember, in the U.S. government, at least. And I always thought it was like as a, you know, you do a couple years service, and I was like, there's nothing I could do there. But like, I'm not saying I could do what you did, but like a little bit closer to, like, I can't write JavaScript, but I could maybe, you know, talk about chips for a little bit, and that would be fun. So that's cool. That's really cool.
Yeah. And I mean, it's, I mean, just to, you know, talk about DARPA a little bit, it's a absolutely unique place, right? You come in there, you have an expiration date on your badge when you come in.
Oh, interesting.
So it's like milk, right? You're expired after 2 years. And then, you know,
can you re-up? Can you get a new refresh badge or no?
If you do well, right? If you start a new program, then you can get re-upped. But then after like 4 or 5 years, they definitely kick you out. There's no, doesn't matter how good you are, you're out.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they've almost had to carry people out of the building because they didn't want to go. And they're like, no,
right,
sorry.
Right. That level of access and like the smart people you probably get to talk to, that's got to be intoxicating. Yeah. Did you have to work in DC though? Is that's probably the big downside.
that was a bit of a downside. I was living in Boston and flying down every week to DC.
Oh wow. Yeah. Yeah.
So I had you know, 50 round trips per year.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that's a lot. That's a lot.
But it was awesome. I wouldn't trade it for anything. I think you know, the DARPA programs, you don't really know how impactful they're going to be, probably for 5 to 10 years, because they are looking out in the future. I think there are some things we did there that will have an impact, or even have an impact today. I mean, you look at like the Open Road. project, for example?
Okay. I would love to get a quick rundown of, like, the, because I'm sure some of the things we've talked about in here, and we didn't even know they were DARPA based projects.
Yeah. I mean, I think probably Open Road is the most well-known one here. I mean, because, you know, that's been used by the eFabless and the Google shuttles and all of that, right? And that's a big.
We talk about that a lot. Yes. Yeah. Tim's come on and talked about that, and Mohammed, and yeah, just a lot of people. So
I mean, the way I kind of structure my programs around things that would help reduce the barriers. So there was a program around chiplets to try to chipletize design. There was a program on trying to make automated compilers, so kind of like silicon compilers. So Open Road was part of that effort. And then there was a program to see if we can make hardware more like open source, where we have an ecosystem of sharing and vetting. So that was POSH. So POSH, ID, and CHIPS were the three big programs that I ran. Yeah, there was definitely some good outcomes from that.
That is awesome. So you mentioned CHIPS, and CHIPS was also used in the CHIPS Act. Was it tied to that? I mean, like, how much exposure was there around the funding sort of thing? I mean, like, anything tied to that, or not necessarily the CHIPS Act?
That name is just name conflict to the fourth degree, right? Like, CHIPS, there's a CHIPS Alliance, and there's the CHIPS Act in Europe, CHIPS Act in the US, but hey, we were first.
Okay, great. I mean, yeah, you have to imagine, like, what a politician is going to understand. Like, oh, CHIPS. Yeah, I get CHIPS.
Yeah. Let's call an acronym named CHIPS. It works.
Yep. Okay, cool. I mean, that is awesome. So I think many of the, so now that we're backdating all of this stuff that we've talked about on the show, it's because of you. Thank you for that. That's been great. There's been a lot of great content on here and a lot of cool things that people are doing. I mean, I think we're also seeing the trailing edge of it too. Like, I mean, so Matt Venn's been on here a couple of times, and just like seeing the shuttle runs, and then the shuttle runs getting the MPW type things, and then Matt then splits them up for the whatever that other thing is, whatever Matt's open ASIC.
Tiny tape out, yeah.
And then tiny tape out on top of that, and it's just like, and now it just becomes like an educational tool all the way back to like making it more and more accessible. So that's gotta feel good, right? I mean, like that's great.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way it's supposed to work, right? That's how software and sharing and development works. You stand on the shoulders of others, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I mean, in my part in this, of course, I did no technical work at DARPA. My only responsibility was funding, selecting the people doing the work, right? So, I can take no credit for the technical aspects of Open Road. The only thing I did was get the program approved.
Hey, sure, that's great. I mean, that's an important thing too, you know. Like that's
but Andrew Kang at UC San Diego, right, was the lead for that effort, Open Road, and he's the one who made it happen, and his team, of course, right?
Got it. So, what I'm really hearing here, Andreas, is I'm going to pick your brain after the show's over. I'm going to get a whole list of guests that I haven't talked to yet, and we're going to get more people on here talking about this.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, please do.
Yeah, that'll be great. Okay. Yes, we found the node. We found the connector node, and we will find other people through Andreas as well. Okay. How can I make this an analogy to? Andreas is the substrate that'll allow us to talk to many different people in different fields, like chiplets on a substrate. Was that a good transition there? That was pretty terrible, but let's talk about chiplets. Let's talk about zero ASIC and chiplets.
Yeah.
Because one thing you did mention, I was on the treadmill this morning, and I was listening, and I was thinking, oh, this is going to be so clever. But you were talking about one thing, and I've forgotten it now. But like one thing around the unit economics. And it was like, it was something where chiplets just popped out as a natural thing. And I thought, wow, that's what he's actually doing now. In 2015, you were talking about it, but now you're proselytizing four chiplets and using them in the zero ASIC project. So how did we get to where we are, I suppose, with chiplets?
So how I started back in 2015 was the high cost of IP. So when you go take something very valuable, and this is not necessarily what other people are doing or what we should be doing, but back then at least, the cost of licensing a piece of IP was very expensive. I mean, we're talking millions of dollars if you want to get a good CPU core or an I/O interface, memory or SerDes.
Sure.
And
we talked to the Raspberry Pi folks last week or 2 weeks ago rather, and they were talking about just the, you know, obviously they're a big operation, but they were also licensing a bunch of IP, and I thought that was interesting too, because I didn't realize that like the RP2040 and all the new chips that they're doing custom in-house are also, you know, just buying off the shelf IP for peripherals. But it's a common thing, and like you're saying, expensive.
Yeah, I mean, it's expensive because it's hard to do, right? Mm. If you say build versus buy, if I were to go out and design a CERTES, a PCI Express CERTES, I would have to probably hire 10 people and, you know, spend 2 years doing it. So if you look at U.S. salaries, you know, say $200,000 per engineer times 10 times two, you're in, you know, it takes you 2 years, so you lost time, and then you don't come out ahead in terms of cost. So it's just expensive. It's not like you're designing a UART or a SPI controller, right? Where one person can hack it in a couple of weeks. This is hard stuff. So I think that's where, you know, the IP is there to stay. That transition happened a long time ago. Like when I started out at Analog Devices, we were designing all of our own IP, our own I/O libraries, PLLs, memory compilers, standard cells, from the transistor up. And we had big teams doing that. And then, you know, 20 years later, it's just gotten worse. You need even bigger teams, and it's more expensive. So that's why the outsourcing that development to IP vendors makes sense.
Mm, yeah. And so what you mentioned, kind of like the scale differences there too. Does it still make sense to do like the lower level things, or is it also from a standardization and just a speed thing? Because like the last week they were talking about, or sorry, last show where the Raspberry Pi guys were doing it, they were grabbing a lot of these off the shelf, you know, SPI, I2C, whatever. So they could have made them, but is there like a standardization argument there too?
Standardization around IP? Or
just like using someone else's work so you don't have to go and re-implement it. Like you said, you could go re-implement it, but just like an efficiency of work sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it would be more expensive to do it yourself.
Sure, right? Yeah, okay, got it.
So I think the pricing tends to be set in such a way that it's not too high. Right? Uh-huh. If they were to say, oh, I'm going to charge $100 million, right, for this IP, there'd be no market. Mm. People will go build it themselves. If they set it at zero, they make no money. So there's an optimal point in the middle there. Where it incentivizes buying it versus building it.
Got it. That makes sense. Okay. Okay. So then one thing that so we've had Ming Zhang on the show talking about chiplets in the past. I think he's the only other chiplet person we've had on so far. And I think Zglue is no longer around, but I know Ming's still doing lots of cool stuff. The thing that popped out from that show that I remember is like process differences also were a big advantage with chiplets, because it's like the thing you're going to put into your Bluetooth transceiver, the process you're going to use for that is going to be different than the analog part on your board, is going to be different than the, you know, the crazy digital fanciness that's on your board too. Is that a big piece of it, or is it more just the IP?
It can be a big part. It depends on how you use it. So let's first go back and define the chiplet, right?
Sure. Okay. You did kind of hedge before. You're like chiplet, whatever that means, right? Seems like it's a contentious term. Is that part of the problem?
Because you mentioned right now, you mentioned Zglue, and I think the question is, what is a chiplet, right? Is it just a silicon die that's small, right? Some people would say that. I don't think that's a sufficient condition. Some people call chiplets these giant SoCs in a package, right? Like AMD and others, right? So I would say a chiplet is a die with a I/O interface that has very short reach that only goes inside the package. So it's designed for in-package integration. That's a chiplet to me.
Yeah.
It implies sort of a disaggregation of the chip. So you shatter the chip into chiplets, each one with a little specialized I/O interface. That to me is a chiplet. That's kind of maybe not the most elegant definition, but that's the chiplet to me.
Okay. The way I had thought about it is kind of like, I kind of visualize, like, if I have a PCB and it's got a bunch of like, you know, SOICs on it, QFNs, whatever, I'm kind of visualizing a chiplet as that, you know, set of QFNs that might be on a PCB. And then the substrate is actually the PCB itself. And it's just kind of like a shrunk down version of that. Is that a good, you know, like the function specific too?
Some people would agree with you. I disagree. Right.
Okay.
So there's been this multi-chip modules for decades now. IBM had them back in the 80s, where they literally would just take a bare silicon die, a bunch of them, put them on an organic substrate or ceramic or something inside the package, and I would call that MCM. And that's basically a tiny PCB.
Yeah, right. Okay.
So that's been around for a long time. But they were just, you know, it was just smaller. There was nothing different about the die itself. And with chiplets, the idea is that we're going to actually co-design it so that it's those IO drivers can only drive other chips that are within a few millimeters or a few hundred microns, right? So they're kind of like they're co-designed, or you know, they're symbiotically working together, right?
Okay.
As opposed to just taking a silicon die and repackaging it.
So what is the benefit then to not, so if you're going to have like, so we're going to have chiplet A and chiplet B, and chiplet A, what, let's make up functions for it. So chiplet A does the math functions and chiplet B does the memory handling or something like that. And they're going to be talking to each other, designed to talk to one another over this bespoke bus with bespoke drivers that are locked together. Why not just smush them together in the silicon? In the design going to the fab and making it one contiguous piece of silicon.
So that's what Moore's law, right? Everybody's been doing that for 50 years, right? So mm-hmm. just integrating on one chip and that's the performance optimal version, because then you get like 13 layers of metal. Mm-hmm. The distances can probably be in the hundreds of microns.
Yeah.
And you know each wire is like a 100 nanometer pitch, right? So the energy efficiency, the cost, the bandwidth, everything is awesome. But you get no modularity, right? You basically compile one function into one thing and it has zero reuse factor, right? Unless you can take that thing as is. And so, I mean, software, we have, you know, libraries, and we have a concept of stacks and abstractions, and you know, like you take Python, right? You've got dependencies and it goes very, very deep, and you can do very modular design very quickly. You know, imagine if you had to like these statically compiled programs without any possible of linking in other libraries, it would be pretty inefficient.
Yeah. Yep.
In software. So in hardware, we have that equivalent. It's just stovepiped binary blobs, every chip. And the chiplets, you get the modularity of software, basically.
Okay. So the disconnect for me is I'm imagining, again, like a chiplet being like a single function, you know, these things are meant to be right next to one another, then how do you actually connect them?
Yeah, so that's the tricky part, right? So in when you're on chip, you use something like AXI or AXI, where it's this, there's AXI streaming and memory mapped, but the memory map abstraction is like, okay, you got a read and a write, you got an address map, and then when you have a transaction, that's how you talk to other devices on the bus. And then, you know, then how is that done? It's usually done with a set of channels, which are, you know, parallel in fashion. You got, you know, read request, write request, you got data coming back and acknowledges. And that's how communication is done on chip. But we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of wires here with just inverters and buffers driving it. When you want to drive on a board, if you're going to drive like GPIO signals, you know, you're off by a factor of 1,000 or 10,000 compared to the on chip, right? So you go, okay, whatever worked on chip really doesn't work anymore. My environment's completely different. So I need to take a different approach. So usually on a board, if you're driving a very specific interface, like a memory, you might get away with driving things in parallel. But if you want to drive a distance fast, then you probably want to use a SerDes.
Uh-huh.
And SerDes they're power hungry, they're long latency. So now you got other problems coming in.
Yeah.
So with chiplets in package, you it's a new domain. It's not on chip where you got 13 layers at 100 nanometer. It's not PCB, where you got really long distances. So there's a new paradigm.
And that's what I'm getting at is like, are the chiplets tiny pieces of silicon mounted to other pieces of silicon, or are they mounted on a substrate? Are they mounted in free air with just dangling wires?
No, there's some kind of connectivity.
Okay.
Usually some kind of bump with a solder cap on it. So they're soldered together.
They're soldered together. Really?
Yeah.
Oh,
so you can have, you know, there are many ways of doing this. I mean, there's a whole field, right? You can have an organic substrate, which is sort of like a PCB, that you would solder these chiplets onto, and that's usually not that dense. It's not like silicon, right? So it's kind of like a miniaturized PCB. You could use a silicon passive interposer, which would be more like a silicon wafer, but just wiring, no active devices, and then you get better density. The type of bump pitches that we're talking about is on the order of like 55 or 45 microns usually if you're advanced, and 110 micron if you're not so advanced.
And what size soldering iron do I use to solder those bumps?
Tiny, tiny ones. It's a reflow process usually, right? You bond it, you very accurately bond the chiplets onto the whatever interposer or substrate you have. And then you use heat and or pressure to do the final bond.
And then, now these things are connected in a variety of ways. What do you call the output of that?
When you assemble them together?
Yeah.
Some people call them system and package.
Yeah. Okay.
That's, you know, if you come from the packaging industry, you probably call it system and package. I think some, you know, some larger vendors might just call it a chip.
Okay.
You know, I think, you know, when people, from a customer's perspective, you know, they don't really care how it was constructed. They care about what chips. And once you package together, what the customer sees is a plastic package or with a heat sink
exactly.
on it.
Black blob, right?
with 1 millimeter pitch ball grid array underneath, right?
So I think, I look at a 1 millimeter pitch ball grid array and I'm like, oh, that's so small. And then you look at a 1 millimeter pitch ball grid array and you're like, oh my God, that's massive. You know, it's just scale differences are great. It's nuts. That's so, okay. And, interesting. And then, so then what's this? So I've also heard SOM, like system on module, and I'm sure there's umpteen acronyms here, but is SOM another term or not a use?
Yeah. So SOM, you kind of, that's to, you know, to me, the step up after system in package. So you got, you know, maybe it's basically a regular PCB with limited IO functionality. So, you know, you can imagine, you know, like for example, Raspberry Pi has a SOM for their processor. Mm-hmm. So instead of putting, you know, all the connectors like a, you know, USB, Ethernet and everything, which takes up a lot of space and maybe application or system specific, you focus on like, okay, how do you integrate silicon devices into a nice abstraction, right? You might want the and take away the hard piece, right? Laying out a high-speed DDR memory interface is always a hassle. So by creating a SOM, you can kind of create this coupled unit between the memory interface, memory device, and the CPU, and then have maybe a high-speed connector to the all the other stuff, right? The low-speed annoying stuff that sits on a carrier. So that's a SOM to me.
Okay, that makes sense. Well, let's talk about then. So Zero ASIC is the company. Yeah, you haven't been in stealth, but you said you've been talking to more people now. I saw you on a couple other podcasts and newsletters and things like that too. So, you know, you're hitting all the very important things like the amp hour, I'm sure, is top of the list. what are you going for then with Zero ASIC? Obviously chiplets, but like what is the differentiator then?
So I think we've done some things publicly. We had we had the Silicon Compiler project that we started 2 years ago and really even released 2 years ago. But that wasn't our product. That was sort of a teaser. But now we, you know, 2 weeks ago we came out with what we actually want to do with details about our platform, and it's all about chiplets. So like our business model is to go, you know, take system customers who want to build something. They would go up to our website and they would select from our portfolio of chiplets using this drag and drop GUI in the web browser, and they select what they want, and that's basically their ASIC. And we assemble it for them.
Faster, cheaper. More flexible, that sort of thing, huh? It's just like it's a drag and drop to have a custom functionality, that sort of idea.
Yeah, it's a you know, block based ASIC builder, right? No code. I mean, think about it, like even we've talked about like open source ASICs or anything, you still have to wait for the ASICs to come back,
right?
Which is you know, could be a year, could be many months.
Yeah,
when you've got all the chips are prefabbed. And even the package substrate is prefabbed, you can assemble it in a few weeks. I mean, if you compare that to a PCB assembly house, if I've got the green PCB in stock and I've got all the devices in stock, I can probably build that up in 24 hours.
Right. Yep.
But if I, you know, if I'm out of stock of one of the devices, then it could be 6 months.
Yep. That longer during the chip shortages. Yep. interesting. Okay. And then, you guys are leaning into the ASIC term a little heavily then, aren't you? I guess it is application specific, but it's, I don't know. I feel like there's a new acronym needed. And I know it's Zero ASIC, but still. ASIC. Yeah, ASIC is feels like there'd be you know, little quote fingers around it, you know?
Well, I mean, in a way, I mean, this is the true ASIC, right? If a customer can dial up and say, I want to build this thing, and that thing that they're building is a unique combination out of a billion possible combos. Hmm. That's a pretty specific device they're building. So I think the term kind of fits.
I'm not worried about it. Like, you know, we're just making conversation here. But yeah, no, it is. It is interesting.
I mean, it's a valid point. Coming up with a new term, you use the old term, people get confused. You come up with a new term, people get confused. So
yeah, totally. Totally. Okay, interesting. So, Who of our listening audience right now, who would you think, oh yeah, they're the ones that should use this? Who's your customer?
We like customers with money.
Ah, yes, I see you've done business before. Ha ha, business.
No, I think if you look at realistically who would want to use this product, there are people out there designing systems who are perfectly happy with what's on the market today. Mm-hmm. And there's like literally thousands of great products in the market, FPGAs, microcontrollers. And if that is good enough, then that's the right answer. So that's not our market. I mean, it'd be silly to try to go and make somebody who's happy happier. And at the top end, if people are only doing smartphones or, they have infinite money, they're probably just going to go away and build an ASIC. Right. They don't care about money.
It's a thousand person design center, right? They're already on the path. Yeah.
But in the middle, when you have people who don't have infinite money and they actually care about performance and they need something specialized, that's sort of our mark. So I kind of like, if you look at some of those markets, I mean, the one that's funded us so far, aerospace and defense, that's a market that has high value applications, size, weight, and power constrained, but actually don't have infinite money to do chips.
I mean,
it's actually very cost constrained. So that's on the engineering expenses.
I feel like I should make a joke here about military spending, but I don't have one in hand, so I'll just leave that be. that makes sense. And I am in the zeroasic.com/emulation menu right now because who doesn't love a live demo where someone's talking and clicking around? I note a lot of ML blocks in there, so that also kind of leads me to believe there would be a lot of that machine learning piece that, maybe putting a Jetson on board is not practical, but you still need some kind of specialized algorithmic learning on your device.
Yeah, I mean the CPU is just not going to be good enough. And so if you want to do anything that's massive matrix multiplication, you need an accelerator on there, and ML is just too ubiquitous to ignore. So.
Yeah,
ML is a core component.
Oh, I'm trying, Andreas. I'm trying, and it keeps popping up.
So the thing about chiplets is sort of like if you can imagine having an infinite number of chiplets, obviously you can create almost anything, right? And so the trick becomes how do you order all the functions you might want to do, because there's only so much time and money to do it. So we kind of say, okay, here's all the chiplets we want to do, and then. We're going to start with the most important ones first. So the most important one we did was a CPU. So we did a quad-core RISC-V CPU. Mm-hmm. And then the second one after that was the FPGA. So we bootstrapped an FPGA architecture. And then the third one was the machine learning.
I have to say, I'm a bit surprised from, the IP discussion we said earlier. I'm surprised that you are building these things. I kind of assumed that it would be kind of off the shelf. You buying chiplets from someone else, but I guess, like you're saying, they have to be. You said these are specialized enough because of the interface between them.
Well, yeah.
Is that why you're building them yourself?
Exactly. So there are no chiplets. There are chips out there. With these
okay.
Functions,
so back, right? There are no back to terminology here. Okay. Yes. Makes sense.
Yeah. So if you were to buy an off the shelf FPGA, first of all, it would become packaged, right? Not a die.
And so I think you could buy dies of FPGAs. Is that a bad assumption on my part?
No. It's true that you can buy a die, but it's not generally available.
Okay. Yeah, I couldn't buy one, but maybe you could.
Yeah, with a fairly high price.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
It would be like you would have to sign a contract that would be pretty significant to get dies.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. So in the short term, Zero ASIC is making these as well to just. I mean, I can imagine you're kind of bootstrapping the market as well, right? You're saying like, well, we have to have these things available, so we'll make the first ones, and then maybe in the future there could be a marketplace type play where other people might make IP or other vendors might be like, yeah, we can make it compatible or lower our minimums if you're going through Zero ASIC, that sort of thing. Once you've captured the entire market and become the next ARM or NVIDIA, right?
Well, so one of the things we had to do was, we really are trying to bootstrap an ecosystem here.
Not a small task. Yeah.
And so for example, one of the things we had to come up with was this chiplet standard. What is that going to be?
Okay.
Because otherwise the chiplets have to be able to talk to each other. And ARM did the same thing with Axie or Namba. They had a processor. They thought it was a good idea for that processor to be able to talk to other IP blocks. So they came up with AMBA, and that's been incredibly successful in the SoC world. And in the chiplet world, you know, there's been lots of efforts to date. So when I was at DARPA, there was this AIB out of Intel. So the Stratix 10 had this AIB interface on it. And as part of the CHIPS program, they open sourced it. It's part not part of the CHIPS Alliance. But it wasn't sufficient. It only had an electrical interface. It didn't have a protocol defined, and it didn't have a pinout. So it wasn't like a Lego block. And so that fell short. So with what we're trying to do here is a full stack chiplet interface. So
yeah,
like a JEDEC type, you know, all the pins are defined, locations are defined, you know, abstraction layer, electrical, everything, right? So it's just plug and play, like USB or PCI Express.
Right. Well, and I mean, as in any standard too, like it honestly doesn't matter until the second person joins in, right?
Yep.
That's I could make a standard for myself that's like, you know, the PCB standard, and I've made pinouts that are standard, but you know, I'm not Arduino, and I'm not Raspberry Pi, so nobody cares about the 25 pin connector layout that I did. Like, that's just the Chris Gammel standard still. Like, okay, it's the second person that cares about it, or the ecosystem that drives it, right?
Yeah, and it's really, really hard to come up with a successful standard. And you can get in a room and talk about a standard, and that usually takes a very long time, and it's hard to get right because you have too many people talking. And too many opinions to converge.
A lot of cooks.
Yeah. And, or, you know, if you're very successful, like Arduino or, you know, with USB or PCI Express, you can have one big company just build something and it becomes the de facto standard.
Yeah. I2C, right? I mean, that's what Philips was them.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's good to be king, you know, like that's the way to do it, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's.
So we decided we're going to go for it. We're going to create, we're going to work on a standard because technically it was, we had the right people to with the skills to review it in house. So we did it, we built chips with it, and then we're going to open it up in a couple of weeks time. So, and then great. Like you said, we'll see, maybe we'll be alone standing with our standard.
You literally can't know it until you try it. So like, it's good that you got to take a shot, right? I mean, it also comes down to like strategy at the next step, with all apologies to community driven efforts. Like, you know, like I feel like a lot of people fall into the hoping that community is going to drive a lot of that stuff, but it's going to be like whoever is the most driven towards getting this thing done. And sometimes it does work out that it's community based things, but it's like, if you can have other people joining in on the standard because they have a business reason as well, or, you know, just a shared goal, I guess maybe shared goal is the better way to say it. That's all often, I think, the thing that's going to drive the highest amount of adoption.
Yeah. I mean, software or standards comes down to contribution. It's time from the right people. And on that topic, that's sort of a sore point for me. A lot of people make comparisons between software and hardware. And like, let's just do in hardware what we did in software. And one of the fundamental differences is that the hardware community is 1,000th the size, right, of software. Yes.
Yeah.
And so so you're not going to have, you know, even one contributor in a certain field, right?
I know this pain personally. I know this pain personally where like, I look at like, I was looking at this tool that had like this amazing documentation and like thousands of commits on GitHub and whatever. And then I like looked at like, you know, I was comparing it to the company I work for and trying to get people to like, again, jump in on hardware stuff and community-based things. And like literally it was installing, you know, like you like copy and paste a JavaScript tag into your whatever you're doing. And it's like, you're there, you're in, you're a contributor, you're part of it. Like, and once that works for hardware, sign me up, because like that's just like the startup time to get up and going and contributing to something is just, it feels massive.
Hopefully
a little easier for you with, you know, maybe with Verilog, it's a little bit better, right? You know, like, or some digital tools around, or, you know, like you're in the hardware realm, but there is some software tooling that hopefully people can contribute with, I would hope.
No, I mean I would say the projects that we've run, and I've run and quite a few and seen quite a few, you know, you're very lucky if you can get an external contributor. It has to be, the environment just has to be perfect. That person has to be excellent, right? Have the technical skills in a very niche field and have the time.
Yep.
And usually time means they have a sponsor, like a university or company or government entity that is willing to let that person contribute time out of the workday. Because if it's on holidays and weekends, it's tough, right?
Yeah, right. Right, and then you as the company being contributed to, it's like you appreciate that, but you can't count on it either, right? So it's also like, trying to estimate when something's going to be pushed out. And I've seen this with the KiCad project as well, right? I mean, like, there's been so many great contributors, and then it really started to accelerate once people were, like you said, sponsored either by companies or funding, whatever. So yeah, it's tough. It's a tough problem to have.
It's fun. I really enjoy the community. I gave a presentation at Latch Up, which is the Fosse conference back in the spring, and it's just a great community, just fun. Very, very friendly.
It is very interesting to hear people that are interested in custom silicon as well, because they come from areas that I wouldn't have expected. I think some of it, I'm not sure what is the driving force on all of it, but it does seem like there's backgrounds and different companies people work for, and I'm not sure what is the driving force. I mean, do you have an idea on what is driving people to get into the space? Maybe like at Latch Up.
Yeah, I think it's personal passion. That's absolutely the thread going through everybody there. I think people want to make a difference, and it's like the true, okay, I'm working on something cool. Let me share it. I want to see it used, right? Yep. I don't want to do it for the sake of earning a salary or, I don't know, for my own enjoyment, right? I enjoy it, but I want to see it used, make a difference. I think it's pretty pure.
That's great. Oh, that's really great. Cool. Well, so again, I'm on the zeroasic.com/emulation page. I do recommend people check this out. What else should people check out on the site if they're like, so they're hearing this, they're like, oh, this actually might be a good fit for me. Like, where do you expect, so like, could I go and click a button to order this right now? Or what is the output of this, I guess?
So what you can do, right, is you can press the emulate button and actually run this is kind of mind blowing, right? Those devices that we have, the chiplets that you can select, the ML, the AI, the FPGA and the CPU, those are actual, RTL of the chips that we've designed. So when you do emulate, those designs get sent up to AWS, to their FPGA instances.
Really?
Bit streams get loaded up, and then you get a terminal coming back that will let you interact in real time with an ASIC that you basically configured real time, right? 3 minutes, right? So you like select the blocks.
We should have led with this, Andreas. That is so cool. That is really, really cool.
I mean, you think about there's like a lot of moving pieces there. It's really incredible team by work by the team here.
Yeah.
With a lot of tech underneath. So.
Huh.
And so the idea here is that when you think about how different that is, right? When you buy a chip from a big company, right? You're basically buying a data sheet. Right. You go up to DigiKey or Mouser, right? And you search the part you want, and they give you a data sheet and say it's $10, and they ship you a part. You have no idea what's going on underneath, right? And you have no proof that it's actually doing what you're buying, except when you put it on the board, right? And it's actually executing. But here the idea is that you can actually, get the ground truth, the RTL code of the data sheet, and run code on that in the cloud before you get the chip back.
That is really cool. Yeah, I just got a Linux terminal. Mine is emulating, so I'm up and running in the amount of time from the click. So that is wow. That is super cool. How much is it? I mean, hosting costs for that sort of thing? Is that a big chunk of if you're just letting people spin up AWS servers for you? Is that
we have a hard limit on our budget there, but basically, yeah, they're spinning up servers that are like $1 to $10 a minute. An hour. An hour.
Oh, okay. That's I mean, it'll add up too if you don't have the auto shutdown type of things.
We do, right? We have, but yeah. So if you imagine, like, if it's $1 an hour, right, you give somebody 25 credits, you just gave somebody $25.
The cost of acquisition. So
But it's okay. We want to show it off, right? And it is a cost of sales, but cloud is amazing, right? It's if you want to reach 10,000 people, you can't do that with a sales force of 10,000 people, right? Unless customer like $1 million. So this is a way of reaching like as many people as possible.
Yeah. I mean, and immediately getting them into it too, right? That's kind of like what I was saying about dropping in a JavaScript thing. Like the sooner you can get someone like actively trying something, as long as they know what they're doing, which I do not currently, then you can get the dopamine hits as fast as possible as well. And I mean, this is cool just that it is booting up the whole thing. And I can see it here. If I knew it was actually going on under the hood, I would, if I could actually use this in a appreciable way with like the ML blocks that are designed into this one, that would be even cooler. So I need to learn more about how to use this, but I'll click shutdown for now. Saving you money. I will save you some money there. Yeah. So, and there are other things in here as well. So it says there's a pre-trained model on the ML chiplet as well.
Yeah. So you can, you can actually go in and, upload an image, right? You know, try something. I did, my son is a big Corgi fan, right? So dog breed.
Yeah.
And so I uploaded a Corgi image, right? And it ran through the detection. And it's like, oh, this is a dingo.
Well, it's doggish,
It's not perfect, but hey, we didn't do that part of the work, right? We just did the hardware. This is not a hardware problem. This is a model problem. So it wasn't trained on Corgis, I guess.
Got it. Yeah. As long as you're not introducing a dingo to another dingo and one of them is actually a Corgi, that would be a messy output, but otherwise I think it's safe. Yeah. That the benefits of simulation, I suppose.
And I mean, the really cool part about this is that you get a terminal into the RISC-V processor.
Yeah.
With an internet connection. So people can, pip install, git clone, whatever they want and start hacking away at it.
Yeah. Is running Linux by default?
Yeah, we use Yocto.
Yocto, cool. Yeah, I guess it makes sense if you're... So then you have to dynamically configure based on the chiplet, or is it like enough of a standardized interface? Like all of them have to have a CPU, so you're at least have that as the Yocto input?
Yeah. So we made our life a little bit easier by always having a RISC-V processor running there.
Got it.
So we have that as a base, but then the other chiplets, that's where we have the pretty cool auto device tree configuration, right?
So that
we can actually, basically build everything on the fly for whatever configuration people put in.
That is very cool. And then again, like thinking about how you'd expect people to utilize this sort of thing. So they could try it out. They can get in there, try out the ML models and things like that. The Verilog is not available, or it is available? I'm not sure actually. They wouldn't be able to replicate it locally? Yeah.
The Verilog is not open source.
Okay.
Except for the libraries that we use that are open source, right?
Mm-hmm.
The chiplets themselves, right? That's what we're going to be shipping. So at the end of the day, this model we have, people play around with it, right? They drag and drop their components as they want. They test it out by logging into it and running their own workload. And then eventually, once we're open for business, we'll have a buy button where people can literally order the device and we'll ship it to them.
And that'll be like a couple weeks versus 6-month tape out sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Wow. That is very, very cool. As we get towards the end here, I suppose we should call out the career opportunities page on your site as well, because I'm sure a lot of people would be interested in working in this sort of thing.
Definitely. Anybody's interested should reach out. We've got an amazing team right now. Yeah, it's the best team I've ever worked with, right?
All based in Boston or all remote? How does that work?
No, all over. We've got most people are in Boston, some people in California. Mm-hmm. We've got, Canada represented, Sweden, Ireland, UK. So we're pretty spread out.
That's great. Yeah, that is the modern dream, to be able to work on hardware all over the place. But I mean, if you can just get straight to I'm sure the tooling is even cooler if you're on the inside. You can get to, you don't have to go through the web browser to get to the configurable AWS terminal. You just get to go straight in. I bet you get SSH keys when you join.
Yeah, we do try to dog food as much as we can, right? So any project that we have that's public, we try to use the way the public would use it. So like for our chip tape outs, this is another project, the Silicon Compiler. For all the chip tape outs we do, we use Silicon Compiler, for example, which is also available as an open source repo.
And that was the thing you mentioned you released 2 years ago, right?
Yeah. So that's the one that, basically, Python-based chip design. You do pip install silicon compiler, and then you're good to go.
Awesome. Okay, just as a quick callback. So I had asked earlier about the types of interconnect, and you do have your own eFabric active interposer. That's
yep.
That is how you're actually making this all happen. So it's kind of a customized, we call it a breadboard somewhere I saw.
Yeah, so that's a good analogy, right? It's a fixed grid connection device. Uh-huh. And so you can take these chiplets, we call them e-bricks, and then you can basically have a finite number of places to put those on, like a mm-hmm. grid. So these e-fabrics come in small, medium, large, and extra large. And you would pick the device that is suitable for your market, right, or your application. The bigger they are, the more expensive they are.
Sure.
And yeah. And so if you take, for example, something with a 4x4 grid on it, right, you have 16 locations to put your bricks. I'm not going to use that word that starts with L because I don't want to get in trouble.
I was going to say, I made a joke about not using the term ASIC, but I was worried the Danes might come after your head if you started violating trademark on bricks.
No, I'm sorry. I'm willing to die on that hill. Bricks is
okay. Is Lego is not. Yeah, okay. I said it. It was Chris saying it, not them. Yeah. It's dangerous, right? I mean, it's such a good example, right? But
I've been tempted, but I'm going to stay away from that.
You know, what you should do is you should offer them a reduced price on custom silicon to put into their Lego bricks. Because they do electronics now too. And then, boom, little cross branding, and maybe you'll be able to put exactly Lego on your site once. They'll be like, yeah, you can use it once as long as you give us free silicon.
one of these breadboards, right? 16 sites, and you put your bricks on top of there, and that's sort of how it works.
Cool. And that's those solder droplets you kind of talked about before. Those would then line up with a lot of this as well, right?
Yeah, those solder drops would sit between the e-fabric and the bricks themselves.
Got it. Okay. Cool. Yeah, that's great. And then that's also the standard that you mentioned defining would be how to make. So if Chris Gammel decided to go and make my own chiplet that I wanted to put into some future marketplace type of thing, it would have to match that standard. Is that a fair assumption?
Yeah. Yeah. So for example, right, our standard relies on a 2 millimeter pitch. Mm-hmm. And so your chip or your chiplet would need to be 2x2 millimeters mm-hmm. or a multiple thereof.
I mean, we're in the US, so shouldn't it be 2.54 millimeters? Sorry, bad joke. I'd never do that. That would be terrible.
You'd be wrong.
I know, it would be wrong. And also, I feel like that would be like a good like April Fool's joke. That would be like, we're going to switch to 2.54 to be, yeah, anyways, that would be, silly. Well, Andreas, thank you for coming back and telling us about this stuff. You have had a very interesting journey to where you are now, and I can only imagine where all this stuff is going with Zero ASIC. I'm hoping it does get to the level of the ARM and the NVIDIAs of the world, just because it's going to enable low cost and faster iteration in the technology space.
Yeah, we're definitely going to keep trying.
Great. Well, people should check out zeroasic.com, and we'll ask Andreas back here in 8 years or less, at least. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks, Chris.